Approximately 9 of the 48 stations carrying this program can broadcast the first half hour only. 39 stations carry the full hour. It is unfortunate that the audience listening to these 9 stations will be unable to hear the second half of this presentation, which carries an important message. Father Coughlin will speak to you during the first half hour on the subject of propaganda at work. Following this, there will be a brief interlude of music during the signing off process of the 9 stations. Immediately, Father Coughlin will return to the microphone for the second half hour and present the meaning of Maxim Litvinov's resignation. This address will be printed only in Social Justice magazine. It will be available to all persons in this audience. Father Coughlin wishes me to thank you in his name and in the name of all his associates for your loyal support, which is making possible the continuation of these broadcasts throughout the entire summer. May I remind you that this is your broadcast, supported by those who are making sacrifices to preserve Americanism and Christianity in this nation. Please feel free to write to Father Coughlin this week, asking for a copy of the most startling revelation he is about to make this afternoon. It is doubted if any publication will carry the full chapter from the book to which Father Coughlin is about to refer, a book not available to any public library in the United States. And now, here is Father Coughlin.
Good afternoon, my friend. Some weeks ago, when discussing the neutrality bill, I touched upon the subject of propaganda, both foreign and domestic. At that time, I pointed out that a real neutrality bill should incorporate clauses penalizing all propagandists whose object is to condition this nation for war. Foreign propaganda is nothing more than an invasion. It does not explode shells, blow up buildings, and directly maim or kill millions of our citizens. Nevertheless, it poisons minds, dynamites peace, wrecks homes, and transforms our population into lustful beasts. To keep free from war, we must keep free from propaganda which leads to war. A neutrality bill which does not take this into consideration, therefore, is weak and futile. On previous occasions, I quoted from responsible Englishmen who disclosed to us the nature and the extent of the propaganda employed to lure us into the world war. Today, I will disclose to you an astounding plan, not only discussed in English political circles, but incorporated in an authoritative book, a plan for propagandizing the United States into the next war. The book to which I refer is not for sale. It is a handbook distributed to a selected few in the inner circle of British diplomatic life. And as far as we know, there is only one copy of this book available in America. It bears the title, The Next War, and is divided into several volumes. One volume is listed as Propaganda in the Next War, and is written by Sidney Rogerson. The editor-in-chief of the entire work is Captain Liddell Hart, associated with the London Times, a great military authority in Europe, and an advisor on defense in general. Be advised, my friends, that Great Britain has cast her evil eye upon us. Unbelievable and fairy-like as this sounds, I am prepared to supply every person in this audience with a reprint of Chapter 4 of the book entitled Propaganda in the Next War to support this contention. From this chapter, I shall quote extensively today to prove that at this moment and for months to come, you and your fellow citizens will be subjected to the most destructive germs of propaganda originating from abroad, germs which will generate a fever of hate and of insanity within our hearts and souls. Senator Gerald Nye, discussing this book on the Senate floor April 25th, and particularly its fourth chapter, said, quotation, "The early pages of the chapter are given over to the manner in which England will handle propaganda in the countries of her enemies." We find the writer pointing out how large a part in world consideration the word democracy is going to play in the next war. How readily it lends itself to a play which will invite the prejudices of a people who may not stop to analyze what is being done to them in the name of democracy. Unquote. This British authority and writer is greatly concerned for fear they are not going to be able to make as large use another time as they did during the last war of so-called atrocity stories. Remembering how easily they preyed upon our minds and worked upon our sympathies by the tales, since proven so thoroughly untrue, tales of the dismemberment of women and children and the other terrible inflictions that were visited upon helpless people. Now they wonder if it is to succeed at another time, in light of the fact, strange as it may seem, that there are so many atrocities being practiced all over the world today without any war being involved. The British writer says in this book, quotation, "Since on paper our case towards neutrals appears to lack a mainspring, it will behoove us to manufacture what we can and press it everywhere we can, a task of making bricks with little straw, at which we showed ourselves to excel in the last war." Senator Nye, commenting upon this passage, observes, "I wish to stress particularly the plans of propagandists to take their straws in the form of statements which lack truth and manufacture them into the bricks which are to be our undoing, destroy our neutrality, and embroil us in another foreign war." Part four of this handbook of propaganda is the one directly devoted to us here in the United States. From it I read the astounding and startling fact. The author says, "There remains the United States the great neutral. In the next war, as in the last, the result will probably depend upon the way in which the United States acts. And her attitude will reflect the reaction of her public to propaganda properly applied. During the Great War, the efforts of the rival forces in the United States almost stagger belief. The Germans were the more amazing, and their activities amounted to a degree of interference in American domestic affairs which will surely never be tolerated again. They entered the field of United States labor politics, organizing their own union. They set up all sorts of propagandist bodies, whether supposedly the Pacific organizations, which adroitly blamed the Allies for keeping the war going, or bureaus to work upon and inflame Negro populations. They appealed to university-trained and professional men. They reached women by forming such bodies as the League of American Women for Strict Neutrality. They even bought a daily paper in New York. Now, we were almost as thorough, though less blatant in our methods, observes the Britisher. Among our multifarious activities was the supply of a regular British news sheet to no fewer than 360 smaller American papers. For some time, the issue as to which side the United States would take hung in the balance. And in the final result was a credit to our propaganda, meaning British propaganda. The writer continues with the following admission. The American people, say, are still under the influence of much of the Great War propaganda. They are more susceptible than most people to mass suggestion. They have been brought up on it. And since 1918, they have shut themselves off from reality. Moreover, they are at this moment engaged upon the battleground of an active propaganda of labels. There is no sense in refusing to recognize that there has always been a substratum of suspicion in America of Great Britain. Admitting the existence of many prejudices on our part against Great Britain, the author of this remarkable book says, in this regard, quotations, there remain the Jews. During the Great War, we bought off this huge American Jewish public by the promise of the Jewish national home in Palestine, held by Ludendorff to be the master stroke of Allied propaganda, as it enabled us not only to appeal to Jews in America, but to Jews in Germany as well. Since then, our attempts to implement our undertaking have landed us in difficulties with the indigenous Arabs, agitated by Italian propaganda without satisfying the Jews. We have not satisfied the educated British Jews. How much less have we satisfied the more remote Jew community on the other side of the Atlantic? In general, continues the author, the situation in the United States is more favorable to Great Britain than in 1914, in that the obvious centers of infection have been removed, but less favorable, in that we have temporarily, at any rate, lost caste as a democratic state because of the propaganda which represents us as truckling to, or at least having truck with, dictators. Though we are not unfavorably placed, we shall require to do much propaganda to keep the United States benevolently neutral, to persuade her to take our part will be much more difficult, so difficult as to be unlikely to succeed. It will need a definite threat to America, a threat, moreover, which will have to be brought home by propaganda to every citizen before the Republic of the United States will again take arms in an external quarrel. The author is certain that there is one challenge which will surely bring the United States into Britain's next war. Here, my friends, are his words. Says, the position will naturally be considerably eased if Japan were involved. And this might and probably would bring America in without further ado. At any rate, it would be a natural and obvious object of our propagandists to achieve this, just as during the Great War, they succeeded in embroiling the United States with Germany. Oh, Machiavelli at his best or his worst was an innocent amateur, my friends, when compared to his lineal descendants in deceit, who at this moment are operating upon you for your destruction. You who digested the lying propaganda of democracy 20 years ago. In part 2 of chapter 4 of this remarkable book, which I am quoting for you, the author continues by saying, during the Great War, the world lay upon the spell of democracy. It was still a world to conjure with. No one had dared to challenge its meaning. Despite the presence of Japan and Russia in the ranks of the Allies and of the near Republic of the Young Turks among the Central Empires, the war was fairly accurately represented by Allied propagandists as a struggle between democracy and the forces of reaction. The implication being that democracy was to stop the world from plunging into chaos and night. From this quotation, you now recognize how insincere were those who prated of democracy 22 years ago. Nevertheless, they are prepared to sing the same siren song to your ears again. They are still depending upon your gullibility. They are still banking upon your unintelligence, as they say, to lead you like sheep to the slaughter tomorrow, as they did your fathers and brothers yesterday. Oh, they are ingenious. Quoting once more from this book, which is privately issued only to the inner circle, and which fortunately has fallen into our hands, let me give you a hint of how the propagandists plan to utilize the cinema, which already is infiltrated with foreigners, and owned and operated in many instances by internationalists. We read in this British book, quotations, in the realm of the cinema, we may be able to depend on the natural bias of the United States film manufacturers in favor of Great Britain as opposed to Germany, Japan, or Italy, and on their command of the machinery of international film distribution. This will be an asset both with the stock entertainment picture and the newsreels, unquote. My friends, already Hollywood has succumbed to the pressure of this foreign propaganda. May I cite one instance of it for you? Recently, the Warner Brothers are releasing a play entitled The Confessions of a Nazi Spy, based upon a story written by Leon G. Turu. Its leading man, Edward G. Robinson, whose offstage name was Emanuel Goldenberg, speaks the following lines. He says, "I am a Nazi spy. I am one of thousands stationed in every part of the United States to steal the secrets of your national defense. There are agents stationed in all the Navy yards of Brooklyn, Philadelphia, and Newport News, in the airplane and munitions factories at Seattle, Buffalo, Los Angeles, and Boston. There's something for you Americans to ponder upon as you seek recreation in the shadow land of untruth. One of thousands of Nazi spies. What truth and proof for that statement? There's propaganda at work while you people pay to be propagandized. Finally, I quote from part two of chapter four of Britain's Handbook on Propaganda. To show what fruits her efforts already have produced in our country, we read, quotations, "Fortunately with America, our propaganda is on firm ground. We can be entirely sincere as our main plank will be the old democratic one. We must clearly enunciate our belief in the democratic form of government and our resolve to adhere to it. Our minor propaganda will aim at attaching the support of important sections, such as the Jews, probably by the declaration of a clear-cut policy on Palestine and of our intention, if victorious, to put an end to anti-Semitic persecution and of the Roman Catholic community in similar terms. These should not be difficult to pursue, nor to put over on the American public. We shall, as before, send over our leading literary lights and other men with names well known in the United States to put our point of view over the dinner table. Our trouble here will be to find men with equally commanding reputations to step into the shoes of such as Kipling, Barry, Shaw, Galsworthy, and Wells. Conversely, we should exploit to the full the views and experiences of American nationals who might be serving in our forces or those of our allies. We should make much of them, decorate them, signal them out for mention in dispatches and in the press, and use their stories as propaganda material to their own people. This was the form of propaganda very ably developed by the French during the Great War. American newspaper men in London are of approved metal, and though impervious to any obvious propaganda, should nevertheless represent a valuable propaganda force on the strength of the day-to-day news they send over. Quite apart from the fact that many of them like this country, meaning England." That is the end of the quotation. From what I have said, this conclusion, my friends, is crystal clear. Namely, that the propaganda machine is already at work. The press, the cinema, well-known citizens, are either wittingly or unwittingly conditioning America for war. The invasion is upon you. Racial and religious psychology is being employed to line up leaders. Catchwords are being used as bait to deceive the masses. Once more, therefore, I restate, what are we Americans planning to do about this foreign invasion? An invasion not of soldiers armed with machine guns, but of professional propagandists who stand behind the ramparts of a dinner table or assault you from the silver screen or the columns of a newspaper as they explode the bombs of poison gas over the countryside of our country. A neutrality bill to be effective in keeping us free from foreign entanglements must penalize those who are busy merchandising foreign entanglements in our midst? A sane parent would not welcome a leper in his home to live with his children. And a sane government must not permit the lepers of propaganda to seek hospitality within our shores and thereby spread the disease of hate, of war, of murder, and of injustice amongst our innocent people. Oh, yes, we have liberty of speech guaranteed to us by our Constitution. Nevertheless, my friends, we are not so simple-minded as to believe that free speech can be employed to destroy free speech, that free speech can be employed to merchandise lies, murders, shell holes, corpses, and broken hearts for the loved ones left behind. Be not mistaken. The propagandists are at work in government, in journalism, and in the cinema. Forewarned is forearmed. Fortunately for us, even Homer nods at times. Unfortunately, even the British publicists have been guilty of an egregious error in permitting their handbook on propaganda to fall into our possession. Probably in future years, the book entitled The Next War, not for sale, not published, sent only to British diplomats. That book edited by the eminent Captain Liddell Hart, and that portion of it entitled Propaganda in the Next War, will be regarded by the unborn generations as the turning point in our attitude towards Great Britain and her invasion of propaganda towards those who are spending billions of dollars in an effort to condition others to fight Britain's wars and protect ill-gotten gain. As I said at the outset, it is not possible during this brief period to quote in full Chapter 4 of the book to which I refer. But I shall print it and distribute it to everyone in this audience who desires to possess a copy thereof. It is yours for the asking. It is a challenge to the warmongers in Washington, in London, in Hollywood, and elsewhere, who would betray the best interests of America for a mess of foreign pottage tied up with a red ribbon of royalty.
Ladies and gentlemen, at this juncture, may I remind you to write to Father Coughlin this week, not only for the portion of the book which he promised to mail you, but also for a copy of the address to which you have just listened, as well as the last part of this presentation, which unfortunately cannot be broadcast over 9 stations of this network. I might mention that the next half hour's address is just as interesting as the first part, and contains a thought for the week on the subject of Mother's Day.
Coughlin's program will continue immediately after station identification.
WHBI, Hoyt Brothers Incorporated, New York, New Jersey.
is a question of unusual interest, which Social Justice Magazine will endeavor to answer in its forthcoming issue. Editorially, its correspondents will remind you that in 1908, Maxim Litvinov, whose name is Finkelstein, the retired Soviet foreign minister, was a common bank robber. Fleeing from Tiflis to Paris, he left behind an unsavory police record. Eventually, pursuing his philosophy of nihilism to its logical conclusion, he cast his lot with Lenin, Trotsky, Velikov, Stalin, and their contemporaries, who began to practice what they believed. World revolution was their watchword. The abolition of constitutional government and religion were their objectives. According to the United States government documents, these men and their associates were responsible for the lives of 20,400,000 Christians, for the confiscation of every religious edifice within the confines of Russia, for the nationalization of real property, and for the regimentation of 160 million subdued persons. Rising rapidly in the ranks of the Red Government to the office of foreign minister, Litvinov championed a program of atheistic internationalism. Openly, he operated through the League of Nations. And secretly, through his forsworn communists in every nation in the world, Poland, Germany, Italy, Belgium, England, France, China, Mexico, Portugal, the United States of America, and particularly Spain, felt his influence. Representing a government which had failed to resurrect Russia from the depression which it experienced following the World War, it was Litvinov's policy to meddle in the affairs of other nations with the hope of dominating the world in the interests of chaos. It was he who supported three different five-year plans for the revival of Russian prosperity, plans which in each instance failed to mature. It was he who failed in identifying the destinies of Great Britain with those of his own Bolshevik government. It was he who stultified Russia at the disarmament conference, and at a later date, it was he who was responsible for the rebuff handed to Moscow at the Munich Conference. Litvinov is credited with but one major victory in his entire career, the victory over President Roosevelt and the American people, when he succeeded in having our administration extend its right hand of friendship and recognition to Red Russia in return for $1 billion a year trade balance, which never materialized. Litvinov represented the worst species of internationalistic atheism to which all decent persons throughout the world are opposed. Recently, this opposition became very vocal in all Christian nations when it was learned that opportunist governments were prepared to make overtures to the Kremlin in behalf of a democratic front. His passing means that the British, French, Russian axis is hopelessly mired. His retirement is interpreted as a step towards nationalism and the abandonment of internationalism on the part of Russia. But deeper than all these deductions, it means that the political planets of Sovietism and Nazism, of Stalinism and Hitlerism, are beginning to move closer and closer, not necessarily to collide and explode to the detriment of civilization, but to follow one the other in the same orbit as they whirl through space and time to some unknown destiny. In fine, Litvinov's retirement is Hitler's victory. Visitors recently arrived from Germany inform us that in certain circles, one hears whispered the ominous words, Der Tag, the day. The day when Adolf Hitler will receive a thunderous welcome in Moscow. The day which marks the end all and the be all of international communism and the merging of two modified policies to oppose capitalism. The day when the most atrocious pogrom in all the world's history awaits those who unfortunately uphold the lost cause of the sickle and the hammer. Definitely, Joseph Stalin and Adolf Hitler have been brought closer together following Litvinov's retirement. And definitely, it is more urgent now than ever heretofore for England, France, and America to revamp their attitude toward Germany and the totalitarian state, with the hope of establishing a new and happier code of international relations, with the hope of preventing the union of the swastika to the hammer and sickle. A thoroughly Christianized Hitler will be more amenable to reason than one who is antagonized if and when Der Tag eventuates. Perhaps the following thought is deserving of consideration. Since 1917, religion has been regarded as a menace by the Soviets. Christianity, particularly, has been scourged, crowned with thorns, and crucified in the Red Square. To what avail? China repulsed the aggressions of the Bolsheviks in Asia. The Battle of Barcelona settled the question of their advance in Europe, logically allowing Stalin and his now predominant Georgian advisors a degree of intelligence. Is it not probable that the men in whose hands the future of Russia rests see the futility of their former atheistic policies? America is reluctant, as far as its citizenry is concerned, to join hands with atheistic Russia in any campaign. England, France, Italy, Germany, Portugal, Spain, Japan, and most of the South American republics manifest the same reluctance among their people, if not among their governments. And finally, Stalin is still smarting for having been excluded from the peace treaty of Munich. He realizes that his country cannot go on forever, labeled as a leper amongst the nations of mankind, he recognizes that Russia will fare better without the services of the international atheists whose shadow palled upon every assembly of diplomats. Is it presumptuous at this early date to anticipate a movement from the left to the right, from atheism to Christianity, from radicalism to sanity, on the part of Russia, now that her erstwhile policies have proven inefficacious? This editorial, which I have just read, is a sample of the news analysis current each week in Social Justice Magazine. A news analysis supported by news articles originating from carefully selected foreign correspondents and the best available domestic talent. Social Justice Magazine is paradoxically proud of the fact that its pages carry no advertising matter. It is one of the few national magazines of large circulation which maintains the policy of total independence insofar as its editorial staff writes what they believe to be the truth. Meanwhile, may I add that it is our prayer for Almighty God to give grace and light to those in whose hands the destiny of this generation rests. God grant them light. God grant that this generation of ours shall see the end of atheism and the conversion of those millions of persons in Russia, the liberation of those millions in Germany, so that the cross of Christ once more will rise glorious and triumphant over both the swastika, the hammer and sickle, and every other national emblem. During the balance of this period, ladies and gentlemen, may I remind you that next Sunday is Mother's Day. By suggestion, today should be Children's Day. Looking backwards through the mist of the years, it is not difficult for us to visualize the day when we were little children, nestled somewhere in a village, town, or prosperous city. There is a humble roof tree that once we called home. Beneath it, once we enjoyed that period of life free from all responsibility, the period of childhood. Oh, yes, there was our sweet young mother, light in body, graceful in form, smiling in countenance, whose days were filled in lavishing her cares upon us. Gone are those days. Gone are the familiar dining room and kitchen. Gone are the ever-recurring Mondays when our mothers slaved for us in the laundry. Gone are the happy hours which she spent supervising our schoolwork. Yes, gone too is that girlish form on whose knee we leaned as we recited our evening prayers. For most of us, still the joy of having our mothers with us in the flesh. For many of us, our mothers have been called by God to share the reward which he prepared for them. After all, my friends, though we are grown to manhood and womanhood, we are still children. Next Sunday is Mother's Day. Yes, if your mother is still living, you will visit her, or write her a loving letter, or send her flowers. If she has passed beyond, perchance we will kneel at her grave or meditate momentarily on that wondrous gift God gave to us in the person of our departed mother. Were you ever proud to hear a friend remark how closely you resembled your mother in physical appearance? Years ago, I remember an old, bowed-down mother telling me a story which this thought suggests. She had three sons and two daughters. One of her boys was the black sheep. His associates were not desirable. His habits were reprehensible. Eventually, he married and brought two little children into the world. Eventually, he abandoned his family and became a registered number in one of our penal institutes. Mother's Day made its appearance upon the calendar one year, and with it came to her a letter from David, the convict. The old lady told me that she experienced the happiest Mother's Day in all the world on receipt of this letter, because her boy David, after having confessed his misdeeds to her, said that he was trying to relive the life which once was his, when he was a little lad, 12 years old. In prison, David recaptured the habit of saying his morning and night prayers. He offered up his labor and the inconveniences of his cell to Jesus Christ, who had been so unjustly condemned in Pilate's hall. David was living for the day when he, who physically resembled his old mother more than the other children, would be free again to prove to her that his soul now resembled his mother's soul. So there is the thought, my friends. If we rejoice when some acquaintance reminds us of our physical resemblance to our mothers, let us pay tribute to her who bore us by endeavoring to resemble her heart, her soul, her virtue. No better Mother's Day could ever be devised. No better remembrance could ever be laid like a wreath upon our mother's grave. Oh, there are thousands of you Catholics in this audience who have strayed away from the faith in which your mothers lived and died. Thousands of you Protestants who have abandoned the precepts of your creed, the creed your mother loved and lived. What greater tribute could you pay to your mother next Sunday than to kneel before the altar of her God and your God and pledge there silently your resolution to be the boy or the girl, the man or the woman your mother hoped you to be. A few days ago, I was reading the story of Saint Monica, the mother of Augustine. Augustine of Hippo was an agnostic, believing little. He prided himself in his false philosophy and the brilliancy with which he defended his radicalism. He stooped to drink the dregs of this world's life, forgetful of the God who created him and of the mother who bore him. And at home, yes, there was old Monica, pouring out her soul day by day to God for her wayward boy. Every heartache this good old mother suffered for Augustine, every trial she endured for him, somewhere in her great soul, there was that sure hope that God would hear her prayer and give the grace of conversion to her wayward son. That was all that Monica lived for. At length, my friends, her prayers were heard, and lo, the renegade Augustine became the great Saint Augustine. My friends, for every one of us, there is another Monica, your mother, praying today for you, her boy, her girl. Perhaps she's dead. Perhaps she's living. No matter where she is, she's either leaning over the parapets of heaven, praying for you, or she's at home, counting her beads, offering her prayers, her worries, and her sickness for you. She's praying today, whether it is in life or in death, for the conversion of you, the wayward boy. Oh, may her prayers be heard. May every one of us in this audience celebrate Mother's Day next Sunday by presenting to her a renewed heart, a clean body, and a sincere soul dedicated to God. May each one of us be able to present our mothers next week with the joy that must have been Monica's when Augustine, the prodigal, returned. My dear friends, this is not sentiment. After all, while we discuss the meaning of Maxim Litvinov's resignation, while we bother ourselves about foreign propaganda and the imminence of war, there is only one thing necessary. Death must come, and after death, judgment, and after judgment, eternity. Eternity in heaven with God and those blessed ones of your ancestry who have earned a reward. Eternity in hell. And there, consternation, confusion, and unhappiness without end. Oh, my dear friends, if we would begin reconstructing our hearts, putting aside the personal injustices which dwell there, recapturing those happy boyhood, girlhood virtues that long since we have cashiered, and building brick by brick with our individual lives a new America with Christ our King and his principles reigning supreme in every labor union, in every political party, in every gathering from which there are absent hate, lust, greed and self. This America, this day, we could look forward to the golden age of Christianity. God bless you, my friends, and keep you and guide you forevermore.
Ladies and gentlemen, once more may I invite the members of this audience to interest themselves both in Americanism and Christianity to the extent of becoming informed on the subject of the dangers which are confronting our peace and happiness. Write to Father Coughlin this week for a copy of the address to which you have just listened and for a reprint of the chapter from the book which he mentioned. And now, in the remaining moments of our broadcast time, with Mr. Guthrell at the organ, the Little Flower Choristers, transcribed at New York under the direction of Emil Cote, sing for us Mother Dearest, Mother Fairest.
Ladies and gentlemen, until next Sunday afternoon at this same time, when again Father Coughlin will be with you, this is your announcer, Franklin Mitchell, bidding you good afternoon.
Ladies and gentlemen, we presented the regular Sunday afternoon address of Father Charles E. Coughlin from Royal Oak, Michigan. The thoughts and opinions contained in this address were entirely those of the speaker and do not necessarily reflect the policies of this station.
Your dial is set at 1250 kilocycles. WHBI, Hoyt Brothers Incorporated.